Here we go. This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, initiating an oral history interview with Dr. Donna Dean, a veteran of the U.S. Navy. Today's date is the 8th of June, 2004. I am in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech in Lubbock, and Donna is speaking to me by phone from Washington State. Good morning, Donna.
Good morning.
Donna, if we could, I'd like to begin by asking you just general biographical questions. Where were you born and when?
I was born on 23 February 1941 mm-hmm. in Ross Hospital, Marin County. My family lived in Mill Valley, California at the time.
Were your parents native Californians?
No. No. My father was from Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, and my mother was from Donners Grove, Illinois.
How did they happen to be in California at the time of your birth?
My father was stationed in the Army mm-hmm. at Fort Berry or Fort Cronkite. They're right next to each other there mm-hmm. on the coast. One of the two, Fort Berry, I think. And my mother had followed the rest of her extended family out to California in the 30s, I think.
Mm-hmm. Had they come out because of the Depression and because things were problematical in the Midwest, or do you know?
I really don't know. Possibly. Mm-hmm. Possibly.
Now, is it the case that your mom had gone to college?
She had, when she met my father, gone to normal school, which was a type of two-year school that turned out teachers. And this was prior to the time when a four-year degree was the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And she did not get her four-year degree until my twin sister and I were 16 years old.
Okay. But she had wanted to have a career in teaching, or was that the direction that was available?
That's, I think, the direction that was available. She had started university, and her father, who was rather unstable, I guess you would say, mm-hmm. had agreed to put her through university and then decided at some point that he wasn't going to do that, leaving her rather stranded.
Okay.
So she went ahead and went into the normal school
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in later years she said what she really would have liked to do was write poetry and to be a nun in the Episcopalian Church, which I found rather stunning. But after listening to her, I think it's true. I think that really would have been suitable for her and something she would have wanted to do. She knew a lot of writers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she loved poetry, and some of her friends, in fact, became well-known writers.
So was she, I mean, is it fair to say that she was something of a frustrated literary person or intellectual, something like that?
She was certainly frustrated. She was frustrated middle class, for one thing, because
okay.
we were anything but.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she longed for a more tidy life, a more, not elite, but a life more dominated by the mind
mm-hmm.
than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
she wasn't well equipped to deal with the grittier aspects of life, shall we say.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And some of those were introduced, I gather, by your dad.
Yes.
Okay.
In those days, no one had any idea what alcoholism was.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been introduced to alcohol. He fought in Nicaragua in the 20s, in the Marines. He joined the Marines at 14.
Okay.
He had a brutal back... Excuse me, I'm going to choke. He had a brutal familial background. His family was Irish, and I strongly suspect his father was a drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to, among other things, tie the children up to posts in the basement and beat them with a horsewhip. And my father had run away with his favorite sister when he was about 12, and the priest found them and made them go back home, telling them to honor their mother and their father.
Mm-hmm.
And my father would get into knife fights with his brothers. There were seven children all together.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was 14, he was very big. He was about 6'4".
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And he ran away and joined the Marine Corps, which in those days was none too careful about certification and documentation and that kind of thing.
Sure. Uh-huh.
And he served as a drill instructor at Parris Island in the Marines for a while, and then he was sent to Nicaragua as an interpreter. And he had what was apparently a heart attack. And there were no doctors, there were no medicines. The only treatment was whiskey. And so he was given whiskey.
Uh-huh.
And he undoubtedly had the genetic predisposition common amongst Irishmen.
Mm-hmm.
And he became an alcoholic in time. And when he met my mother, he had gone from the Marine Corps to the Army and never rose above corporal. And then he would be busted back down to private for fights and drinking. He was exceedingly violent on the outside, never to his family. But she simply wasn't equipped to deal with that. No one would have been back then.
Yeah. And, of course, not much of a network for her, at least in formal terms, perhaps informally within the family, but in formal terms, networks to support spouses. Just
no, there wasn't any.
Just
and there
around.
Wasn't any within the family either.
Okay, so she was kind of on her own handling this.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And your dad at some point switched from the Marines then to the Army, am I right in thinking
yes.
that?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he was approximately how old then at your birth? Any idea?
I think mid-30s.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And, Donnie, you were one of a set of twins.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Do you have a brother or a sister?
I have a twin sister.
Okay.
And she lives nearby.
Nearby you now?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Uh-huh.
That's good.
She's about an hour away.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
However, she hasn't always. We've both moved around a lot. Her primarily in California, me all over.
Sure. What kind of a career, if she's had one, has she engaged in? Can you just give a brief sketch of what she has been doing?
Well, she's had a very sad life. She's had four husbands, all of whom were extremely dysfunctional, three of them alcoholics, all of them abusive, and she herself has a very peculiar drinking pattern, but it is technically it doesn't fill the bill for alcoholism,
mm-hmm.
because she can quit when she wants to. But she suffers from bipolar disease.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And when she gets into a depressive cycle, she drinks enormous quantities of alcohol.
Okay.
And she continues to do that until she cycles out.
Okay.
So
mm-hmm.
she's had a basically a minimal fringes sort of existence.
Okay, yes, it sounds quite tumultuous.
Yes, she's never had any kind of security. She has worked very hard, but most of the time for little or no wages, because she would allow herself to be exploited.
Mm-hmm.
And she hasn't even worked enough to have come up with the decent social security income.
Mm-hmm.
So she lives on, now her last husband burned himself to death last summer in a drunken stupor. He burned his mobile home down around himself, and she's living on his social security.
Was that an intentional suicide, do you know, or is it not clear?
It depends on how you define intentional. He knew he would kill himself
uh-huh.
if he continued to drink the way he did and to smoke and to consume unbelievable quantities of Pepsi, because he had huge bleeding ulcers.
Right. Uh-huh.
And he often said he had no reason to keep living, and he didn't make any attempt to stop drinking. He wouldn't admit he had a drinking problem.
Wow.
And he essentially had been killing himself for the, I don't know, the last 15 years or so since his first wife died of cancer.
And
to my knowledge, he never made any effort whatsoever to change anything. He was evaluated. I kept prodding,
mm-hmm.
and he was evaluated for alcoholism. But, of course, if you lie about your behavior to the evaluator, you're not going to be diagnosed as an alcoholic.
Right, you can stay outside the criteria.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You just say no. No one's ever said anything
exactly.
to me.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So in that sense, yes, he committed suicide. Did he mean to do it that night? No. He fell asleep in a chair. He'd gotten to the point where he sat in his chair 24 hours a day. He had a caretaker, and she would come in, and he would have soiled himself and didn't move, couldn't walk, couldn't stand up, would fall down on the floor drunk and couldn't get up, that kind of thing.
Wow.
And the inevitable end, of course, since he was a chain smoker, was that he would burn the house down, which he did. His chair caught on fire, and then the house caught on fire, and that was the end of it.
Wow. Donna, is your sister recovering from that, or was that, you know, something that released her in some way?
She has manufactured a mythical past.
Really?
And sees herself as the grieving widow. Nobody can understand the pain she bears except other widows, and so on and so forth. And We don't talk about it too much. I told her the best thing that could have happened other than shooting the son of a bitch between the eyes was for him to die.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't find that sensitive. I don't know why.
I don't either. It seems eminently reasonable.
Yeah,
if
it does
nothing
me.
Else.
But...
Well, Donna, let's talk about you.
I
know that... I know that your sister, just by virtue of the fact that she's a twin, by the way, is she a fraternal twin? Or
yeah, okay. Fraternal.
Mm-hmm. Is, you know, she's certainly, you know, linked to you in a particular way. But I really wonder if we could talk a little bit about your growing up and things that interested you when you were just a youngster. What kinds of things were you drawn to? Music, writing, science?
I love books.
Okay.
And animals. But when I was a child, before I went to school, I locked myself in the bathroom as long as I could get away with it,
mm-hmm.
and taught myself how to read. We always kept the Reader's Digest in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, for many years until I was an adult, I thought there was something vaguely nasty about the Reader's Digest.
It was linked in your mind.
You didn't mention it in polite company. But I taught myself how to read. And one day, my mother said I just issued forth and proceeded to regale my mother and my father about the complete life cycle of bees.
Really? Now, you taught yourself to read? I mean,
mm-hmm.
this is extraordinary.
It was something I guess I felt compelled to do. My mother always had books.
Mm-hmm.
She had a complete set of famous literature, you know, one of those.
Yes, uh-huh, great books or something
like
that. Uh-huh.
And she loved reading.
Mm-hmm.
And my father, while he only had a limited education, had a photographic memory. And he was extremely intelligent, possibly more intelligent than my mother,
mm-hmm.
and never forgot anything he read. So when he was sober, there was a lot of discussion about different topics. And somehow I put together that books equal knowledge equal interesting life.
Okay, right.
And so by the time I went to school, I could read. I could read adult things like magazines and newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never had to sit there and do the C-spot run stuff. I was allowed to sit there by myself and read whatever I wanted to read because my mother was a teacher, and the teachers knew her. And so I was indulged, I guess you could say, in that aspect. And whenever we went over to anybody's house, I was raised with the concept that children are to be seen and not heard.
Mm-hmm.
All they had to do was give me a pile of magazines, and I was happy. You wouldn't hear a peep out of me for hours. And when I got older and could go to the library, I read some incredible stuff. In fact, one of the earliest things I remember reading is a series of books by Mary Laswell, who wrote Tuner Schooner and Suds in Your Eye.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if these titles mean anything to you, but they were written during the war.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
About some old ladies that live in the Ark in San Diego, and they just make do. I mean, they literally piece their lives together selling gardenias to sailors and working in the tuna factories and things,
mm-hmm.
and they're very, very funny. and I loved them. In fact, when I joined the Navy and was later stationed in San Diego, I was thrilled to death to actually find this bar they used to, the books used to mention.
No kidding.
Where they, yeah, they had a tropical storm. You know, they had palm trees and stuff painted on the wall, and they'd have this tropical storm with thunder and lightning. And I actually found that bar. It was a real place. And I was so excited.
It's real. It exists.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I started to talk to the bartender about it because these books were part of my blood by then.
Sure.
And he didn't know what I was talking about.
He didn't have a clue.
No. And I was just crushed. And I was stationed at headquarters, 12th Naval District, directly across the street from where the Ark would have been if it had been real.
Mm-hmm.
The Ark was actually supposed to be a junkyard with an old shack built of planks, and these ladies drank beer in massive quantities, and the wall was made up of beer cans full of sand. I just love these books.
Yeah.
They're collector's items now, mm-hmm. and I have one entire set and part of another.
I was going to ask if you'd found a way to get hold of copies.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I've put together several sets and given them to friends
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because I wanted to share them with people because they're old and few people remember them now.
Right. Yes. I mean, I certainly am not an expert on children's fiction or fiction at all, really. But I had not heard of them. So it's good that you. It's great that you mentioned them. Actually.
Well, they weren't children's fiction.
So they were sort of. Who was the target audience? I mean, was it
adults?
Adults.
Wartime.
Okay.
The storyline took place during the war,
okay,
and the characters were all involved one way and another. The main characters were these four old ladies, but they would have contact with soldiers and sailors actually, not soldiers,
mm-hmm.
and one of them has a nephew who's in the Navy, and he's a bosun's mate, and in time, he marries, and they have a baby back in New York, and the old ladies get into this huge old Cadillac and drive across country to see the baby, and they're just funny.
Yeah, it sounds pretty cool. It sounds
they're
good.
They're funny, yeah. And no matter what is thrown at them, they survive. I think that's what appeals to me as an adult,
mm-hmm.
that no matter what they run into, they come up with some ingenious way of beating the system, and they survive it.
Mm-hmm.
A tax accountant is a con artist, and he takes their taxes. They're about to lose their beloved Ark, so they go to work in the tuna factory to put together enough money to pay the taxes. And later, in the next book, they nail him for bootlegging. And
it sounds pretty good, actually.
You have to read them.
Yeah.
Mary Laswell, I cannot recommend them highly enough.
Yeah, it sounds like a must read.
Oh, yes. But anyway, I think I loved reading more than anything, and it took me to worlds I couldn't go otherwise,
mm-hmm.
because really my life wasn't really very happy under the circumstances. And the other thing that got me through life was access to the outdoors. And did you read Deep Six?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, those Marin Hills are real. And everything that I talk about, with the exception of She Coyote, of course, mm-hmm. is real, and they're still there. Everything's like it was because it was made into a natural refuge or recreation area.
It's a preserve of some kind.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So it's still intact, but my sister and I would spend every available moment up in those hills playing
mm-hmm.
by ourselves or with another little girl,
mm-hmm.
and they were magical to me. You've never been to California, I suppose.
Oh, I have been, yes, I have.
Have you been there?
I've driven through there, although I didn't spend time there. But it's a gorgeous, obviously a beautiful part of this country.
Well, the fog rolls in the evening, and a solid bank, and it literally rolls over you. You can sit and watch it from a distance and see it come over like a blanket.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's sensually exciting. It's a sensory overload almost
mm-hmm.
to kids in particular, I think, because suddenly you're in another world and everything's muffled. You can't hear anything. You don't hear the traffic down on the highway. You don't hear any of the voices from Marin City. You don't hear anything. And that was wonderful. And some of the places we lived had vast tracts of forest, ponderosa pine and sugar pine mostly,
mm-hmm.
that hadn't yet been logged. And we spent a lot of time in the woods. And even my grandmother had a little six-acre place, and next to it was a very large fruit orchard. And even the orchard was a grand place to play in because there were no people.
Mm-hmm.
There were just the trees. And on the other side of it, which seemed a great distance to us, but of course it wasn't. We were very small, but on the other side of it was a belt of woods, pine woods. And that, I think that if I could have, I would have spent all my time out like that. And I have a dog that I love beyond words.
What was your dog's name?
Her name was Mittens.
What kind of dog was she?
She was a husky mix.
Uh-huh.
Probably a collie husky mix. She was very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were living in Marin City, we only had a very small yard, and she was quite a guard dog, and somebody tried to poison her twice, so she had to go to live with my grandmother.
Was that a neighbor or somebody who did that? Do you have any idea?
Just the kids, I suppose.
Go ahead, Donna.
The kids that grow up in a situation like Marin City are often quite violent and angry,
mm-hmm.
and they will victimize the small, the helpless, the young. And she made them angry by barking, I suppose. But they also poisoned a couple of kittens that we had, too. A kitten was no threat.
Right. It was something that was being done. There was a little fad or something that they were some kids were doing this.
I suppose. But anyway, Mittens had to go live with my grandmother.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
It was, especially since it was quite a distance from Marin City to Grass Valley, where my mother lived. I mean, my grandmother lived.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't get there that often. And when we went, Mittens didn't recognize me.
That's tough. That's very hard. You're speaking to a confirmed dog lover, so I think I have some empathy for what you're feeling and what you felt at that time. Donna, tell me about your own experience with education. Did you like school? You mentioned that at least part of the time you got to do, in terms of reading, you got to read.
Yeah, that I liked that.
Mm-hmm.
But I apparently have very, very minimal right brain damage, possibly from my father's alcoholism, and have never had the capacity for math, and certainly not in a standardized way.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't do well from the beginning, and I was humiliated by the teachers at the critical juncture when I was learning the more complex things like addition, subtraction, and division. And I remember clearly one event where we were learning carrying,
mm-hmm.
and I was trying to be a good girl, because if anything was emphasized by my mother, it was, don't humiliate me, you're my daughter, to be good in school. So I went down my paper, and I made the cross outs and the carrying signs,
mm-hmm.
not knowing that you weren't going to have to carry with every one of them. And my teacher came along, and she saw my paper, and she snatched it up and crumbled it up and threw it away and mm-hmm. yelled at me for being a bad girl, and I was stupid, and I didn't know we were going to have to do any carrying, and I should stay with the class and pay attention to what she was saying and not get ahead. So it's silly now, but what I should have done is bitten her on the leg. That really stuck with me, and
uh-huh.
I could never do the math. Clear up through grad school,
uh-huh.
I couldn't do the math. And at one point in algebra, I always had to take remedial math.
Uh-huh.
But I would always also get into the advanced English courses.
Sure, right.
And I would be bored to tears with the rest of it. And I would occasionally get into trouble for other things, like in the junior year of high school, we were supposed to write stories. And I wrote a story having to do with racial discrimination, and the teacher called my mother to school to tell her that I shouldn't be concerned about such issues at my age, and she was very concerned about me involving myself in things like that. This is one time my mother stuck up for me. Normally she didn't.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What happened in this incident?
She told her that she saw nothing wrong with having an interest in that sort of thing, that it was part of life, and there was no reason to think a junior in high school was unaware of such issues,
uh-huh.
particularly since I had lived in Marin City and seen it.
Can you tell a little bit about that, Donna?
What
kinds of things had you seen in Marin City that caused you think, to have some awareness of racial difference and discrimination?
Well, the things I say in Deep Six, other than the specificities, are quite true. Tamil Pius was the high school for Marin City. Well, first, let me go back a little further.
Sure.
We moved to Marin City as we were going into the fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And on the first day of school, I walked in and was beaten up by black girls. And I didn't say anything about it, but they would beat me up pretty badly. And that went on for a couple of weeks. And then finally, they decided we were going to be best buddies because I hadn't told the teacher on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't a snitch.
Mm-hmm.
But it was my first experience of racial discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, when I went to high school, the kids I'd been playing with all along were suddenly in one group, and the white kids and mixed Indians and Mexicans were in another. And we were still friendly, but we weren't friends as such. And it was so seamless that looking back, I'm not sure when it happened or how,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but there was no interracial dating. It wasn't even a question.
Okay.
We just knew it. It was as though it seeped into us through osmosis, even though we'd grown up together.
Huh.
And I think that racism was so pervasive and systemic that there was never one point where you were told, never the twain shall meet. It was just sort of accepted by both sides. And the only time that was broken, there was an annual race riot, and it was called that, with Sir Francis Drake High School in the nearby town of San Anselmo, to which I ended up going later,
uh-huh.
my sophomore year.
Uh-huh.
And then all the Marin City kids fought for TAM against Sir Francis Drake. And that was lumping us all together as Marin City kids, period, regardless of melatonin.
Uh-huh.
And that was kind of unique, I think.
How did that race riot day or event happen? I mean, it happened every year around what time?
Football season.
Okay. Uh huh. So the
there would be an agreement of where it would be, and the boys would go physically fight. The girls didn't really do anything.
Did they go?
No.
Okay, they weren't even there. The girls generally weren't there.
Uh-huh. No. Uh-uh.
So it would just be like a free-for-all between the guys?
I guess so.
Oh,
and
my God. Wow.
I don't think there was any serious damage done. As far as I know, chains and knives and zip guns weren't used.
Uh-huh.
It was just sort of a fist fight
kind
of thing.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think anybody ever got seriously hurt. I never heard about it anyway.
Wow.
But it was one of those traditions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That football has passed on to all of us.
Yeah. I did not know. This is true, as odd as it might seem. I did not know how prejudiced my parents were. And my father was missing at this point, so it would have been my mother. But I had a friend in school named Johnny Rhodes, and he was black.
Mm-hmm.
And I was out washing the windows in the parking lot one day, and he drove by and he saw me out there. And he drove in because he was so proud of himself. He had a car. And cars were rare amongst the poorer high school kids.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
And here he'd gotten himself a car, and he was showing it off to everybody he could find.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over and admired it and so on and so forth, and we talked a little, and then he left. And I finished washing the windows, and I walked in the house, and my mother was sitting in a chair in the middle of the room with this really odd, glazed look on her face, and it scared me terribly. And I kept asking her what was the matter, and she wouldn't answer. And finally she started saying repetitively, "My own daughter, my own daughter." And I'm by this time beside myself saying, "What did I do? I finished the windows. Why are you mad at me? What have I done?" And finally she said, "You were talking to a nigger." And my jaw dropped open and my heart sank down to my feet, and I said, "That's Johnny. That's Johnny Rhodes. I've known him since I was in the fifth grade. All I was doing was talking to him. He came by and saw me and showed me his car. What's the matter with that?"
Mm-hmm.
And she kept saying, "He's a nigger. He's a nigger." And that was the first time I had any idea how my mother felt about things. Now, mind you, she had sent my sister and me to Bible school at the Holy Roller Black Church with all the black children.
Why was that?
Well, that's what there was.
Okay.
And she usually taught during the summer.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And it was a place to send us to do things, and you did crafts and things.
Sure, like a vacation Bible school.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And then at the end of it, we did go to church, I remember, and everybody's hooting and hollering and waving their arms and singing, and I got really into the spirit of it and got saved.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was kind of cool.
It is kind of cool.
You know, it just got caught in the spirit of it.
Well, there
all.
You go. There you go. I mean, that's the whole point of it, isn't it? I mean, that's what everybody was doing.
I guess so. I don't know what my mother thought about it.
Well, had you ever heard her use that word before?
Not that I recall.
Never heard her say.
However, it was so commonly in use, I might have.
Okay. Okay.
But it wouldn't necessarily have sunk in.
Wouldn't have struck you in the way this is.
No. And later I was to hear a great deal more of it.
From her?
And everybody in the family.
Okay. Hmm.
And when I was stationed in Naples in the late 70s, my first cousin and her husband came to visit and to do some touristing around.
Sure.
And I was involved by then in that horrendous situation in Naples and was trying to talk to her about what was happening to me. And she relieved herself of the opinion that God created the races separately and there should be no intermarriage and there shouldn't be any living in the same neighborhood kind of shit. And I was stunned that she still bought this crap at this age, because by then I was quite an informed and activist liberal, I guess, flaming liberal.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're in your mid-30s at that point and
living
your own life. And,
yeah, right. Uh-huh. And here she is. She's Ayn Rand's younger. And here she is coming off with the same old Nazi line. And I thought, my God.
Mm-hmm.
Where have you been, my dear?
And actually, that's of interest. Where had she been? Had she been living somewhere in the, you know, living some kind of secluded life?
No, she hadn't. However, she had not had much exposure to people of color, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking back, there was... we went to junior college together. We lived together.
Okay, uh-huh.
And we remained close until I joined the Navy and she married. But there had been a young man that I had a crush on,
mm-hmm.
but he had a crush on her, and she wouldn't date him, and I could never understand it because he was this absolute hunk.
Mm-hmm.
God, he was gorgeous. And he was Japanese.
Uh-huh.
And I later discovered that she was just as prejudiced against Asians as she was against blacks.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And she had never changed, I guess. And I hadn't realized it because where we went to junior college, Santa Rosa, California,
mm-hmm.
there weren't, as I recall, any black people. There were Asians,
right.
And some Mexicans, but no blacks. So, beats me.
So in that context, the African-American issue didn't really come up, at least when you guys were living together.
But afterwards, we both moved to San Francisco, and we went to a couple of these dances that they would have for the servicemen.
Sure.
This was during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And we would be bused by the Red Cross to Hamilton Air Force Base and Travis Air Force Base. And whether the whole Air Force was like that or not, I don't know, but there were a great many blacks at Travis and Hamilton, and there would be trouble when the black guys would ask us to dance, and then the white guys would want to fight over it, which just disgusted me. But my cousin had never said anything.
Mm-hmm.
About the blacks wanting to dance with her.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times what they wanted to do was start fights. You know, young men are young men, regardless
sure.
of color.
Sure.
But she hadn't said anything. And after she married a sailor.
Uh-huh.
I would have thought she ran into blacks, but maybe not. It certainly came as a surprise to me.
Huh.
And I'd been tootling along
right.
my life, becoming this wild-eyed feminist.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when I was stationed in Italy, I was in the Equal Opportunity Program. And I was a human resource management specialist, and it was our job to go around and educate the crews of the ships on race relations. And that's what I did. So imagine what a shock this was.
Absolutely, to come, you know, out of your own family to have this kind of thing come up and...
Your whole family is just slightly to the right of Hitler. Oh, God.
Don, I want to ask you about that, the work that you did in, based out of Naples, and also, you know, the situations that arose for you there. But first, if you agree, I'd like to find out about your transition from being a civilian to actually inquiring about a military career. How did that arise?
Well, it's really kind of a neat story.
Okay.
I was working for the telephone company. I had an AA degree.
Which you had from Santa Rosa?
Right. Mm-hmm. And reality had set home because I worked in San Francisco. Well, I started out in Santa Rosa, telephone operator. Then I transferred to San Francisco as a service rep. Or no, I'm sorry. My cousin was a service rep. I went to work for the Yellow Pages.
Okay.
And there were thousands of women working for the phone company in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them made more than a dollar or so above minimum wage. And they only went to the first line supervisor positions. And none of them had any access to the more lucrative positions of the higher supervisory levels or, in particular, sales.
Mm-hmm.
And sales were immensely lucrative.
And this was apparent to you. You were looking around and observing this.
Yes.
Because this is the early 60s. This is what, 61 or 2 or something like that, somewhere in there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I worked in an office that was basically a city block long. And there were desks. We women were divided up into three sections. And there was a woman supervisor for each section.
Mm-hmm.
And we were divided up by alphabetical order within the Yellow Pages.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I had washing machines through V. Anyway, there was one woman supervisor at a desk in the middle of all the rows of minions.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle of the room, behind that supervisor, was a desk occupied by the overlord of the three sections, and that was a male.
Uh-huh.
And then at the end was a desk occupied by the supreme overlord, who was a male.
Uh-huh.
And there was never any question about moving up. I became quite good friends with my supervisor, and we talked about this at length. In fact, we remained friends until we lost contact just a few years ago, really.
Mm-hmm.
And she was accepting of it in a way, but quite forthcoming about the impossibility of moving up in the phone company.
Mm-hmm.
And I had asked about transferring to sales because, frankly, I wanted more money. I was making minimum wage. Living in San Francisco, I got malnutrition because I could not afford food, rent, and bus fare.
What part of San Francisco were you living in?
I started out, and this was prior to the hippies.
Sure.
I started out on Haight Street.
Mm-hmm.
And later moved to Diamond Heights.
Okay.
And I lived in a little two-room basement apartment in someone's house. And it was really quite a choice place in that it had a magnificent view. But it was as cheap as you could get at the time, was $90 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived there until I moved away to finish university to get my bachelor's to get a commission.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an uncle, my favorite uncle, my grandmother's brother, George Bowles, who was even then quite famous locally and in California, because he had sailed with a great white fleet. And he used to talk about it all the time, and going into Catania after Etna erupted and helping rebuild Catania, rescue people. And he had stayed in the reserve until he had to retire. Then he joined the fleet reserve, and he continued to work until just before his death in his late 90s. And he would show up at the fleet reserve dinners and things as a speaker. And I adored him. He liked us kids. And I guess I had been complaining about my lot in life, because back then all you could do was the kind of work I was doing, or you could be a file clerk or some other menial job for minimum wage. I mean, there was nothing else. And he said, why don't you join the Navy? And I thought, what a cool idea, because I really like sailors with their tattoos and their skin-tight tailor-mades and their embroidered cuffs turned back and their gold earrings.
That was all looking pretty good.
Whoa, yeah.
Okay.
So I thought, well, that's a thought. And he said, you can get a commission with 2 years of college. Because when he was on active duty, you could. So I contacted the recruiter, and I was pretty much aware that we were going to go to war in Vietnam by then.
Now, this would have been in 1963?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they sent over to my apartment the commanding officer of an all-wave unit at Treasure Island in the reserves. At first, they told me I couldn't be an officer with 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent Tina Catino over to talk to me. And she's, good old Tina, we're still in contact. She's a beloved friend of mine.
Okay.
And she was so enthusiastic about it, the reserves and the fun I could have, and I could work my way up. I could finish college, get a degree, get a commission. And I fell for it. So I said, oh, well, why not? It's 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year. I'll make some extra money.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have a good time. And boy, did I. We met at Treasure Island, and there were just a handful of us, and several of us became inseparable. And one of them was a black woman named Vicki Monroe, who, if I didn't think of some kind of prank to pull, she did. And we had more fun than a barrel of monkeys. I could hardly wait for drill night.
Really?
Yeah. And still, we had our chief petty officer and our first class made us work.
Mm-hmm.
We did better than all the male units on the base in the academic coursework and the drilling and all that, because Tina wasn't putting up with any kind of hanky-panky, and neither were the chief in the first class. But we still had a wonderful time. And, of course, there were sailors everywhere. And it became not just apparent, but it became reality that we were at war. And the papers were full of the bodies coming home from Vietnam. The anti-war demonstrations were in full cry. And I decided I would indeed do what I felt was my duty, finish school, and get a commission.
Now, when did you actually finish school?
I went back in 1965 and graduated in 1967 by the skin of my teeth because I had to cobble together enough credits. I've always been not a dilettante, but a butterfly, sampling this, that, and the other thing academically.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have enough credits in any one thing to get a bachelor's degree except Spanish. So I was pushing the age limit for a commission. Had to finish in 2 years. So I declared Spanish as a major and journalism as a minor,
mm-hmm.
and put together enough credits to do that.
And what institution did you get the degree from then?
At that time, it was Sacramento State.
Mm-hmm.
It's now the University of California, Sacramento campus.
Okay.
And I went to summer school as well, picking up additional credits I needed at American River Junior College because there were some things I had not done that were necessary for the bachelor's.
Right, you had to fill some, requirements.
Right, mm-hmm. So I basically was in school continuously. Until I graduated in 1967 and left almost immediately for officer candidate training school in Newport, Rhode Island.
Okay.
Got a commission, the rest is history.
yes, it absolutely is. Donna, let me ask you a little bit about being in the Bay Area during this time period, 65, 66, 67, you mentioned that the anti-war movement was developing. Of course, there's also a musical movement going on and a lot of cultural change happening, and a lot of the triggers of that were centered there in the Bay Area. How much of that did you see or experience? Any incidents come to mind around all of that?
Well, one, I wasn't involved in it. I still feel very, very strongly about it. There was a lot of publicity about a nurse, Susan something or other, who was demonstrating against the war.
Mm-hmm.
And she had been put through university by the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And I and everyone else I knew felt nothing but contempt for her. I mean, here she avails herself of a free education. We had to pay for ours. And then she bites the hand that feeds her, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time and throughout my career, and this is a very shameful thing for me now.
Mm-hmm.
I was a hawk of the first degree. I believed everything I was told.
Mm-hmm.
I believed we had to go to Vietnam. I believed in the domino theory. I believed we were doing the right thing, and I thought the anti-war demonstrators were a lot of spoiled, rotten, middle-class kids playing at poverty, living in the streets and everything the way they did.
Mm-hmm.
And what they needed was a good, swift kick in the ass and to get drafted.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, I did not see the other side or even consider it. And it possibly part of it was self-protective, but when you get into the military, you exist in a bell jar sort of existence, mm-hmm. and you become a part of a culture, and you don't really participate much in the outside world. I was older than the hippies to begin with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I barely made it under the wire at the age of 27 to get commissioned. Mm-hmm. So I didn't relate to them anyway due to age. And I would have in class, speech class in particular, where we were forced to speak, I would have some very now embarrassing things to say.
And you say that because your political views have shifted, to
say the least.
Yeah.
Yes, we had no business being in Vietnam, none whatsoever. And I would not admit that until 1983. I just couldn't face that. However, I had already developed an inability to deal with anything regarding the war, even though I never went. It would...
Meaning you never were actually posted in
no,
country, right?
No, I wasn't.
Right, uh-huh, uh-huh.
But I couldn't deal with the casualties and the waste of life. And the information I received was all from one side. And that's very common in the military. That's why you see these people in Iraq mm-hmm. worshiping President Bush and saying, we're doing the right thing, we should be here, this is right, we're getting rid of the evil dictator, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same bullshit that Vietnam was. And I even applied to go to Vietnam. They opened up one billet for women officers in the Navy to go. And I applied for it, and so did everybody I knew. And the woman who was selected was the daughter of an admiral, which is predictable.
Who was that? Do you have any idea?
I don't recall anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah. But that was how it went down.
Yeah, and you might have known mm-hmm. that it would be, because it would have been the single most career-enhancing thing a woman could do at the time in the Navy. And I was in, actually, my period of service covered a very interesting time when women were their own separate entity, the WAVE.
Yes.
And then we were integrated into the regular Navy, supposedly. And prior to that, when I was still an ensign, they had opened up the grades for women to go from commander, which had been the top rank for a woman, with the exception of a temporary captain who ran the WAVE, and they opened up captain's ranks, and there was a eye-opening, horrendous thing I saw firsthand with that, too.
What happened there, Donna?
Well, I worked for a World War II commander, and she had, at that point, 26 years of 4-0 fitness reports. She was a superb commander. And, boy, she taught me a thing or two.
Who was this, Don? And
her name was Camille Houck, H-O-U-C-K.
Mm-hmm. And where were you when you worked for her?
Commandant 12th Naval District.
Okay.
And she worked for a captain who, in turn, answered to the admiral. Both the captain and the admiral were stone drunkards.
Okay.
And the admiral hated women. He loathed them mm-hmm. in his navy.
Mm-hmm.
and he had already gotten me. She gave me a perfect fitness report because I was good. Mm-hmm. I was really good. And getting a 4-0 out of her was a real honor. Mm-hmm. And he changed it and gave me some mediocre marks, saying that no ensign deserves a 4-0 fitness report. He would never have done that to a male. But he did, and he had the power to do it, and there was no appeal.
It was just arbitrary.
Yes, uh-huh. And there was nothing I could do about it, and there was nothing the commander could do about it. Uh-huh. So I'm sorry to say that one day I was in there. He had complained about my skirt being too short. And it was, I suppose. I had good legs. I was beautiful enough to make strong men fall down on the ground and bite sticks, and that didn't bother me at all to make use of that. And anyway, she had been dressing me down because he said to. And I started to cry because I hadn't really been able to internalize the unfairness of his changing my fitness report, which would be a part of my record forever.
Yes.
And harm my career forever. And she, I don't know, she had taken to drinking a lot.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those World War II women used to sit around the officers' club at noon and drink martinis.
Mm-hmm.
One right after the other, and she had joined them.
Mm-hmm.
And she must have been feeling vulnerable or something. And she hauled out her fitness report and showed it to me. And he had literally destroyed her career out of nothing more than hatred of women in his Navy. She had perfect fitness reports for 26 years, and he gave her a mediocre one that immediately assured that she would never make captain. Because at this time, all the commanders had kind of piled up in a log jam,
right,
since they couldn't go any higher. And she was ultimately forced to retire when she reached the statutory limit for active duty as a commander. And later, he finally went too far, I guess. He used to do the most childish things out of spite. I spoke Spanish, of course.
Right.
And he didn't have a Spanish-speaking officer on his staff. And so he had no choice but to invite me to his cocktail parties and receptions for Spanish-speaking officers that came into port, Spain, Peru, Chile, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they would make ports of call, courtesy visits. And I would be in the reception line, and he would pretend he couldn't remember my name.
Nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But he had no choice but to invite me because most of them either didn't speak English or would refuse to speak English.
Right.
And ultimately, in dealing with the Mexican authorities, which had to be done on a fairly continuous basis because of the border, I would have to be included, and he would wait till the last minute to have me sent for, hoping for a miracle from heaven that they would suddenly speak English. And of course they wouldn't.
It also caused you maximum upset, though.
Oh, yeah, right.
Right.
Up three flights of stairs to the lair. But one of the funnier things that happened was, well, I have two C stories. You want C stories or do you want to skip those?
Go ahead and lay them on us, Donna. Why not?
Okay. I was involved in frequent meetings in Tijuana with the Mexican general and the mayor and the chief of police, because I would go along as an interpreter. Well, they all thought I was cute as a bug's ear, and they didn't take me seriously, which at the time I didn't care. I was away from the office and having a good time, got a free lunch. But the general truly did not speak English. The chief of police and the mayor did, but they would pretend they couldn't, just to be assertive, I guess. Anyway, the general showed up at headquarters one day with a whole bunch of armored jeeps and soldiers hanging out all over with guns and bandoliers. And the Mexicans are very, very showy with their armaments. And I saw them, but I didn't hear any word about go up to the admiral's office, so I just sat and waited, and sure enough, phone call comes. Get up here. The admiral wants you right away. Apparently Mexico thinks we bombed them, and they're on the brink of declaring war. So I go trotting up to the admiral's office, and the general tells me the story. And what it really was about was he had brought all the troops across the border to tell the admiral that he was terribly sorry he couldn't come to his barbecue because he had to take the troops out in the desert to try to retrieve what was apparently a weather balloon that had fallen in the Mexican desert. And he wanted the admiral to know that he deeply regretted this. So that served as fodder for one of my stories of how I averted war with the Mexicans. And then another incident, the Japanese training force came in, and they were on their way to Mexico, and they needed something, but no one could understand this one officer's English. And he was their interpreter in Spanish. He was the only Spanish-speaking officer in the Japanese Navy.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I was invited to a reception on board their ship to meet him. I have trouble dealing with numbers anyhow. And I was all excited about this, going on board the ship in my dress whites and so on. So I showed up shiny and gorgeous in my single gold stripe and my white uniform and got piped on board and greeted by the admiral and the Japanese admiral. And there was a lot of consternation when I said who I was supposed to meet. And after a while, this officer hurries up to me, and he's kind of disheveled for a Japanese. They're very, very tidy and breathless. And we conduct our business, and I leave. And I'm getting all these poisonous, well, first, I was allowed to cruise and graze amongst the hors d'oeuvres and things. And then I left. And I'm getting all these poisonous looks from the admiral and his aide, my admiral. And I have no idea what I've done wrong. I mean, I was supposed to find out what this guy wanted, and I did that. So the following day, I got hauled up to the admiral's office again and chewed out by his aide. The admiral didn't deign to do it himself.
Mm-hmm.
That was not the cocktail party I was supposed to attend. That one was for flag rank and captains. And I was supposed to go the next day to the cocktail party for the minions. So I went the wrong day.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I stuck out like a sore thumb. I'm sure the admiral never got over the humiliation.
Right, right. A terrible day for him. A black, black day.
Oh,
I can see
God,
that.
Yes.
I can see that.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. So well, I'm quite sure he was glad to see the back of me when I left, which I soon did. I didn't spend a whole tour there.
That's right. What was your next place that you went to after that?
Lowry Air Force Base in Colorado, the Navy unit.
And what was the Navy unit doing there at the base, at the Air Force?
We were administrators for the Navy and Marine Corps attendees of the various intelligence schools. We kept their records.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the medical side of things. We had our own corpsman. Nobody trusted the Air Force to do anything with the sailors except teach them the courses.
So you had sort of a separate little space, basically, which was
yeah,
providing services.
Yeah, we had our own little building and our own barracks, and the Marines had their barracks. There's another funny sea story associated
uh-huh.
with that.
Uh-huh.
And we even built ourselves a little recreation area, stealing everything from the Air Force without their knowledge, because I had a old-time bosun's mate working for me. And those old-timers knew how to get anything they wanted.
He was a scrounger?
Oh, no, a thief.
A thief, even?
Okay. He would get a truck and drive up to where the Air Force had all these piles of gravel for the roads.
Right.
And he would load up an entire truckload and take it back until he had enough gravel to cover this whole area for this little recreation kingdom he was building. He stole the wood to build a picnic table. He commandeered barbecues. None of it was legal.
Right.
But he did a bang-up job. But those old bosuns were a breed apart. They really were.
Was that someone who had come into service during World War II or the Korean era?
Probably Korea.
Uh-huh.
He was in his 40s, and he was only an E3.
Uh-huh.
And we became quite good friends, and he used to tell me that all he needed was enough money to go get drunk and get laid.
Mm-hmm.
And a hammock to sleep on when he got back to the ship, and three squares a day, and he was happy. And he was.
Mm-hmm.
And during his time, the regulations changed that if you didn't change or didn't move up, you had to get out.
Yeah, right.
And so he got promoted, of course. I mean, he knew everything there was to know about being a bosun. He'd been a coxswain for some of the highest-powered admirals in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And he made it all the way up to first class, and then he steadily descended into a morass of misbehavior and getting put up on report for drunk behavior, fighting, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
because he didn't want to be a petty officer. He wanted to be an E3 with just enough money to fool around with and have nobody bothering him, because nobody bothers the leading seaman. Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't married. He didn't have a family. As soon as he got promoted, he married a woman with some children, and that didn't go well because he just wasn't a husband material,
right,
much less a father.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, it was rather tragic. And I think the Navy should have left well enough alone with those men, because they were of inestimable value. Have you ever seen the new version of South Pacific with Glenn Close?
No, I have not.
I'm quite last night. There's a character in there that's played by, I can't think of his name. Anyway, he plays a bosun like that, who's running this entire black market operation all by himself.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the kind of guy Billy Warden was. That was his name, Billy Warden. It just ruined him.
Yeah.
Ruined him. And I loved having him work for me.